Awesome. So, I think this will be the last time that I bring anything prepared. Because we really, during the last week, it is actually quite important, I think, that you have more dialogue, uncertainties, any final qualms, you know, to give you as much confidence, frankly, as we can, before you depart. But there was one more morsel from the Vajra Essence, which I think is very useful, and pertains directly to our practice, this final phase of awareness of awareness. And this is once again in this section of the text where Dujan Lingpa is drawing these very sharp and clear distinctions, as we saw in the other two preceding passages. And so, I thought this one was especially pertinent, clear, helpful, illuminating. I hope you find it so as well. So, here once again is the teacher, Samatabhadra, manifesting as Padmasambhava in this vision. And he states, Ovidyavajra, so the being in this vision with whom he's having this dialogue, Ovidyavajra, if you do not know how to distinguish between consciousness and primordial consciousness, you may think consciousness is primordial consciousness, and consequently circle about in delusion. So learn how to distinguish between them. So this is a theme that's come up repeatedly, and we see it, for example, in the text on Mahamudra by Panchen Rinpoche, where he goes into awareness of awareness, to write together with settling the mind. And he said, when you come to the culmination of this practice, you've now realized the essential nature of the mind, but that's the conventional essential nature. Whereas many people, many yogis in Tibet for generations, not having sufficient instruction, not having the bigger picture, they come to that experience, and then they simply assume it's the ultimate. It's Dharmakaya, it's emptiness, it's Rigpa, it's something really super duper. Whereas in fact, it's in Galupa terminology, of course, as you well know now, it's simply the subtle continuum of mental consciousness, or in Dzogchen terminology, the substrate consciousness. So, and moreover, when without having ascertained emptiness, without having ascertained Rigpa, one simply rests in open presence, just open awareness, like that, well, what are you resting in? You may think it's Rigpa. The word Rigpa is very easy to say, so I'm resting in Rigpa. I'm resting in mashed potatoes. Actually, Rigpa, say I'm resting in Rigpa, is easier to say than I'm resting in mashed potatoes. So Rigpa is very easy to say. But how do we know it? Well, he's going to clarify this. Okay? So learn how to distinguish them, between them, and that is primordial consciousness, simply consciousness, different word, shepa, and primordial consciousness, yeshe. So first of all, consciousness. Consciousness is the naturally present radiance and clarity of the unceasing objects that emerge in the expanse of cognition, which, when they enter the sense doors, are bound by self-grasping. So that sheer, just the radiance, the clarity, the manifestation of all appearances, just that is the display of consciousness, right? As stated before, if there were no consciousness, there would be no appearances. So consciousness is illuminating and manifesting in these unceasing objects. That is, whether it's the empty space of the mind, whether it's mental objects, sensory objects that emerge in the expanse of cognition. Cognition is this manas in Sanskrit or yi in Tibetan. There were brief references about that earlier. And so when these unceasing objects, when they appear, they enter the sense doors, and then as they enter in, then the self-grasping that comes out, the labeling and the reification come out. But the sheer luminosity of them, that is a display of consciousness. When looking out through the sense doors, so this is all six modes of cognition, when looking out through the sense doors, that which appears as seeing, or that which is experienced as seeing, hearing, feeling, experiencing, and contacting external sensory appearances is called consciousness. So that which manifests is that very seeing itself, that is consciousness. Insofar as consciousness individually apprehends and recognizes labels and things, and arouses the three closely held feelings of pleasure, pain, and indifference, all things appear to be separate and distinct. So this is when consciousness is conjoined with cognition, which demarcates and then labels, recognizes this object having these attributes and so forth. So all of these phenomena, they appear as to be separate and distinct. They are given individual labels and things are apprehended as being distinct. That acts as the basis from which emerge thoughts of attachment to one's own side and aversion to the other side. So now we see how this connects in with equanimity, or the opposite of equanimity, and why equanimity is needed, right? So that acts as a basis, that very apprehension of the objects with the labeling and so forth, seeing them distinct. Well, of course, the distinct then will be also the distinction between the other side and one's own side. And overall, as a general theme, attachment in terms of all that is considered to be my side, there tends to be attachment there. And where there's aversion, that tends to be to the other side. So even if, to give a little bit of commentary here, in this modern syndrome, I just don't see any reference to it. In all the reading I've done, I'm not that erudite, but I have been reading Buddhism for 40 years, I've never seen any references to self-loathing. They don't have a word for low self-esteem. You know, self-contempt and so forth. And as you might recall, when I first mentioned this to one very traditional Tibetan monk, the abbot of my monastery, and told him I experienced it, he just looked at me and kind of, no, you don't. No, nobody experiences that. That's crazy. You don't like yourself? That's not possible. You know? And so it really is a cultural deal, right? So what I'm saying here is that when we enter into that kind of syndrome, the person that we don't like has become the other side. And the judge, the evaluator, the critic is now inside. And the critic is saying, I'm okay, but you're not so okay. So that kind of division of inside and outside can even occur within our own being, let alone within my family. I like this family member, don't like that family member. So now I've split my family. And then we just kind of split on from there. Oh yeah. So that acts as the basis from which thoughts emerge, thoughts of attachment to one's own side and aversion to the other side, for which the remedy is this morning's practice, equanimity. The good is apprehended as being good and is made into an object of hope, thus proliferating thoughts of yearning. The bad is apprehended as being bad, and that serves as a basis from which various thoughts of anxiety arise. What is called cognition, or manas, and that is where it's involved in appearances and distinguishing appearances. What is called cognition manifests as the consciousness of appearances. So you might recall, if you're remembering several weeks back, from the substrate emerges the substrate consciousness, from substrate consciousness emerges afflictive cognition, from that emerges manas, cognition, and then everything rolls. Because then we have the appearances, the labeling, the distinctions, and then craving, hostility, and everything else arises. So what is called cognition manifests the consciousness of appearance. It turns into appearing objects, and it causes appearances to be made manifest. From the very moment that a thought and a subject arise, what is called mind merges non-dually with appearances and vanishes. So when we get caught up, in cognitive fusion, mind arises and then it goes and gets sucked in. We all know what it's like. I think it's called OCDD, right? Where we really lose our minds because they get sucked up into, abducted, carried away by some thought, memory, and so forth. So it merges non-dually with appearances and then vanishes. It vanishes because we get totally fixated on the referent of the thoughts, thinking about this, remembering that, hoping and fearing that. Now, in contrast to the preceding, primordial consciousness is the natural glow of the ground, and it expresses itself in the five facets of primordial consciousness. So I think there's no need to go into those right now. Primordial, mirror-like primordial consciousness of discernment, of equality, and so forth. Five. You can check them out. They're easy to find. So primordial consciousness is the natural glow of the ground of being, and it expresses, manifests itself as the five facets of primordial consciousness. Now, this is my translation, of course. And the five, what I'm calling here the five facets of primordial consciousness are generally called the five primordial wisdoms. It's not an incorrect translation, but when those words roll off my tongue, it seems too reified. It seems like they're five boxes, five different things. This kind of wisdom and that kind of wisdom, like five types of cookies or something. And that's clearly not the case. And so when it says here that the primordial consciousness is the natural glow of the ground, it already suggests light. It expresses itself. One could say, perhaps pushing the metaphor, it refracts itself. It's the natural glow of the ground. It, like light going through a prism, it refracts itself. It expresses itself in the five facets of primordial consciousness. So that would be my choice. Because primordial consciousness is a more literal translation than primordial wisdom. The Tibetan is simply ye she. Ye means primordial. She means consciousness. It doesn't mean wisdom. So that connotation of the primordial consciousness then being refracted and manifesting in like in five colors strikes me as having a bit intuitively more on than simply five primordial wisdoms as kind of like just five different things. And so speaking of them as five facets then has a connotation of a refraction, like light refracted through the facets of a jewel. Anil, any comments from your side? You've got so much background here. Any plus or minus? Any thoughts? Is it just... Okay. Good. Thank you. Yeah. And it's really that. I mean, I'm not refuting all that. These are fine translators who say primordial wisdom, so I'm not refuting them. It's just, it's more like that, which seems to capture a little bit better, because after all, the words should lead to it and not away from it. So there we are.
Doesn't she just mean knowing?
Yes, it is knowing. Yeah, so primordial knowing, and that's a little bit odd, nobody says that, but generally, shepa is translated as consciousness, or knowing, either one, but consciousness is simply that event of knowing. Yeah. So hearing, seeing, and so forth and so on. So, specifically, let's read the last. Primordial consciousness is the natural glow of the ground, and it expresses itself in the five facets of primordial consciousness. Specifically, in the manifest state of the ground, great primordial consciousness, which has been forever present, when this abides as the aspect of limpidity and clarity. Limpidity is a close translation here. It means transparent and luminous. Limpidity has a dual connotation, so does this Tibetan term, tangwa. So I'm breaking it up a little. I hope it's not too distracting. This primordial consciousness, which has been forever present, when this abides as the aspect of limpidity and clarity, like the dawn breaking and the sun rising. So in the manifest state of the ground primordial consciousness, which has been forever present, I have to rephrase it. Specifically, in the manifest state of the ground, great primordial consciousness, which has been forever present, abides as the aspect of limpidity and clarity, like the dawn breaking and the sun rising. It is not blank, like an unceasing darkness that knows nothing. So it's not like the substrate. All appearances are naturally present without arising or ceasing, just as heat is naturally present in the nature of fire, moisture is naturally present in the nature of water, and coolness is present in the nature of wind. Due to the unceasing power in the nature of primordial consciousness, there is total knowledge and total awareness of all phenomena, without its ever merging with or entering into objects. Primordial consciousness is self-originating, so it doesn't arise independent upon other causal conditions. It is naturally clear, free of outer and inner obscuration. It is the all-pervasive, radiant, clear infinity of space, free of contamination. What are the causes and conditions by which consciousness is transformed into primordial consciousness? What are those causing conditions? They are accurately knowing how thoughts of the phenomena of samsara and nirvana emerge, including the eight aggregates of consciousness and sensory appearances, and realizing the manner in which they are naturally perfect as the play of the divine embodiments, the four or five kayas, and facets of primordial consciousness in the nature of ultimate reality, or dharmata. That's a big sentence. And it covers so much. How is consciousness transformed in primordial consciousness? How do you ascertain consciousness as being of the very nature of primordial consciousness? And what are those causal conditions? They are accurately knowing how thoughts of the phenomena of samsara and nirvana emerge. So just generally, how thoughts of any kind, how do thoughts emerge? Well, you'll recall that in settling the mind in its natural state, you're not really examining, probing, scrutinizing the exact, factors of origination, how it's present, how it dissolves. That's slipping into vipassana territory. It's more simply being present with, right? Not investigating, not labeling, just being present with. And the whole idea of settling the mind in its natural state is that the mind simply dissolves. You're not trying to understand it right now so much as to allow it to simply dissolve into its natural state, uncontrived substrate consciousness. But on that basis, when you have that stability, that clarity, then you go directly from the shamatha practice of settling the mind in its natural state to the vipassana practice of actively inquiring into, investigating, scrutinizing how the mind emerges, how thoughts emerge, how thoughts of all kinds emerge. For starters, so now you're really probing into, by way of vipassana, into the nature of the mind and not simply having your coarse mind settle or dissolve into the substrate consciousness. So it's accurately knowing how thoughts of the phenomena, all kinds of phenomena emerge, including the eight aggregates of consciousness, that's the six ordinary modes of consciousness, plus afflictive cognition and the substrate consciousness, how all these emerge and how sensory appearances emerge, and realizing, so there's one, and knowing that, of course, that implies insight into emptiness. How do they emerge? They emerge without inherent existence. There is no inherent emergence. There is no inherently existent birth or arising of any of these phenomena, either the thoughts or the appearances. So on the one hand, realizing the emptiness of all these phenomena. And then on the other hand, and realizing the manner in which they are naturally perfect, as the play of the divine embodiments, mnemonikai and so forth, and facets of primordial consciousness in the nature of ultimate reality. So it's realizing their empty nature and realizing their nature as naturally perfect displays of rikpa, or the five embodiments, mnemonikai and so forth, or the five facets of primordial consciousness. That's where it goes in the Dzogchen. So first it's vipassana, realization of emptiness, and then out of that, the Dzogchen realization of all of these appearances, all these modes of cognition, being simply displays of, and naturally perfect as the displays of, primordial consciousness. Then from the time that one identifies the Dharmakaya, pristine awareness that is present as the ground of being, one's consciousness is transmuted into the play of primordial consciousness. So this is a close translation. I try to be quite literal in the translation. To say that it's transmuted could imply it wasn't before, but now you've added some drops to it. You've catalyzed, you've changed it, and so now it is something that it wasn't already. That's not the case. It already was, but you didn't see it. Right? So from your perspective of not really ascertaining the nature of consciousness, to ascertaining the nature of consciousness in terms of where it's coming from, its ultimate nature, then it appears to be transformed rather like in a dream being non-lucid and then lucid. All right? The dream really didn't change. It's the same dream. But now you're realizing the whole of the dream as a display of the substrate, whereas before you're all grasping onto it as being really out there. Right? So, in a manner of speaking, your consciousness is transmuted into the play of primordial consciousness. It already was. But from the time that you realize, you identify pristine awareness that is present as the ground of being, then from that vantage point, from that perspective, now you see consciousness is nothing other than the play of primordial consciousness, which of course is what it already was primordially. Then regarding consciousness, by the illusory display of concepts of self alone, your own self concepts. By the illusory display of concepts of self alone, primordial consciousness takes on the guise of consciousness. So the concepts of self alone, this is self-grasping. Who do you think you are? Oh, I'm Nicholas. Oh, I'm Rinchen. That's who I am. By this illusory display of concepts of self alone, primordial consciousness takes on the guise of consciousness. It manifests, it appears as consciousness. Like a pile of stones being mistaken for a man. The transformation of that into primordial consciousness is like recognizing a scarecrow for what it is instead of seeing it as a man. So consciousness takes on the primordial consciousness takes on the guise of being consciousness, just ordinary consciousness, because of the reification, the grasping. But when we break through the reification, the grasping, ascertain the actual nature of consciousness as empty, and then ascertain it as being simply the play or display of primordial consciousness, then it's as if consciousness transmutes back into primordial consciousness. It doesn't really, but that's what it seems to, from that perspective. In that shift of perspective, looking from the dualistic mind, as opposed to observing from primordial consciousness or pristine awareness. Oh yeah. In this way, the correct realization of the mode of being of consciousness transforms it into primordial consciousness. It is not that consciousness must vanish into absolute space, or the Dhamma Dhatu. It's not that it first has to vanish into something, and then primordial consciousness must arise from somewhere else. Instead, know that it just seems that way because of the functions of self-grasping and identitylessness. Either you're grasping onto things as having an inherent identity, or you're realizing them as having no inherent identity. Viewed from one perspective, things appear this way. From another perspective, they seem like that. So it's so similar again to shifting one's whole perspective from a non-lucid dream to a lucid dream, where the dream itself seems to change. Well, in a manner of speaking, it does, but in another manner of speaking, the dream doesn't change at all. It's just your insight, your perspective on it that changes. We come to the end. Consciousness is what makes the first moment of knowledge emerge in the aspect of the object. It illuminates, and then there's an object, just an appearance. Just as various images of planets and stars emerge in the ocean. So consciousness allows for the emergence of the appearance, the object, just like the reflections in the ocean. What arises is closely held by conceptual consciousness. So consciousness just illuminates the appearances. But then the conceptual consciousness then grasps onto, labels, identifies, classifies, reifies. Closely held, dualistically held, by conceptual consciousness, it is bound by a reification, or we grasp onto the inherent nature of whatever is arising to the mind, and one thereby becomes deluded. Knowledge of the reasons for that bring one to primordial consciousness. So it's rather like a mystery novel, figuring out, how did this happen? Who done it? What was the sequence? What was the chain of events, the causal sequence that gave rise to consciousness appearing as something autonomous, separate from primordial consciousness, having its own inherent nature. So when you trace how that happened, and you see it, and then not only intellectually, but then you can trace it back experientially, then you roll back the carpet. Out of delusion, it rolls forward into delusion, dualistic grasping, and everything else. By seeing that causal sequence, then you roll it backward. From sheer dualistic grasping, responding with craving, hostility, hope and fear, rolling it back. Rolling back to manas, to cognition, which is simply aware of the distinctions of appearances. Rolling back to afflictive cognition, this more primitive or primal coagulation of self. Rolling back into substrate consciousness, prior to that congealing of the sense of I am. Rolling back into substrate consciousness, then ascertain its nature, probe into its nature, break through its nature. This is directly from Prahivatsra, Garab Dorje. When the question is raised, what are you breaking through? Tekchut. What are you cutting through that's hard and gnarly? And he says substrate. It's a substrate. It's not just ordinary dualistic mind. Do that with Vipassana. It's not the coarse mind. You do that with shamatha. But having come to the substrate consciousness and then breaking through that, that's the consciousness he's talking about here. Breaking through that to this primordial ground, then that's the shift, shamatha vipassana, and then into dzogchen. So something like that. So, no more. Less practice. Samadhi without a sign. Anila, I just phoned Sikkim. And Yangtze Rinpoche is back from Tibet, but he's in Nepal, in hospital. So, Chris. Settle your body, speech, and mind in the natural states. Then with your eyes open, your awareness resting evenly in space with no object, for a little while just be present without distraction, without grasping onto any object or appearance. And then this most intimate of knowledge arises quite naturally. The closest. The knowledge of being aware. The knowing of being aware. Rest there. Sustain that flow with a sense of ease and relaxation. Sustaining it with continuity of stability. And with the natural clarity of awareness itself, sustain the flow of knowing. Awareness. Non-conceptually, release thoughts instantly as soon as they arise. And let's expand the field of awareness by directing awareness straight up into the sky, into the space immediately above you, as far as your mind can reach. All the while, throughout the entire session, sustaining gently, like holding a thread delicately between two fingers. Sustain the flow, the thread of awareness, as you extend your awareness, direct your awareness up into the sky. With no object, as far as your awareness can reach. And then utterly relax. Let your awareness rest in its own place, quietly illuminating, knowing itself. Direct your awareness out into the space to the right. with no extension, no direction. Let your awareness rest right where it is. Out into the space to the left. Back to its own place. Down into the space of the mind below. back to its own place. Let your awareness descend to the heart. If you find it helpful to disengage from the visual field, you may close the eyes. And so relax, so let go, that the very locus of your awareness descends to the heart, rather than visualizing the heart from above. And utterly release your awareness into space in all directions. Total release. With the eyes open. with utter ease and relaxation, simply let your awareness rest in its own place, in its own nature, ever so simply being aware of the sheer luminosity or clarity and cognizance of awareness itself. Mala, so quite a bit of accumulated mail. Let's get to it. So a question from Nico. With settling the mind in its natural state, it seems that one goes nakedly through the healing process of the mind. Or nakedly, yes? Nakedly. Yeah, very good phrasing also. And nakedly in the sense of there's no buffer. There's no mystery about it. It's not mysterious. You're actually seeing it happen, you know? And that is there you are, and you're just watching the coils, the knots and so forth of the mind untangle themselves. And so it's naked in the sense of no mediation. You're right there watching the whole thing take place. It's quite remarkable. How does this process leading to shamatha take place with other techniques such as mindfulness of breathing or visualizing the image of the Buddha? It's interesting. Each of the different shamatha methods leads to access to the first jhana, all common in that regard. They all lead to substrate consciousness or subtle continuum mental consciousness. We all have that in common. But they have a different flavor. They have a different impact, right? So even though the endpoint, once you're there, is the same, the process of getting there by different means will condition the mind, or have an effect on the mind that is quite different. So for example, if one spent 6 months, a year, year and a half, focusing with very deep reverence, devotion, faith, and so forth on an image of the Buddha, gradually stabilizing, clarifying, but having the sense, as we're encouraged to do in the classic teachings, to really now just imagine as if this is the Buddha himself, you know, that you're actually in the presence of the Buddha. Well, by the time you've spent, 5,000 hours of doing that, that's going to have quite a big impact on the mind that was doing it. So even though once you achieve shamatha, like a sangha describes, achieve shamatha, and then you simply release the image, after all, it was simply an image. Even though now resting in the substrate is pretty much the same thing as resting in the substrate or substrate consciousness by way of settling the mind, the influence on the mind through that process will be very different. So for example, an advantage of that, I've spoken so little about visualization techniques as a method of shamatha, but it's for very good reason that all four schools of Tibetan Buddhism do strongly emphasize it. And that is, for example, when you're dying, you know, okay, this is it. This is my last day. If you've spent thousands of hours, let alone achieving shamatha, and there you are dying, and then you have the ability, because you've developed it so finely, of just calling the Buddha to mind, and not as a visual display, but really invoking the Buddha, you know, as you can think of your mother. It's nothing, in a way, nothing so mysterious. You can invoke the image of your mother, and in so doing, attend to your mother, right? We all know that. You can develop loving kindness towards your mother as you invoke a mere image, but by way of the image, attend to your mother. That's all very clear and familiar by now, isn't it? Right? So in a similar way, if you have developed shamatha, achieved shamatha by way of focusing on a Buddha image, an image of Tara, or whoever it may be, and then you're in the dying process, you may evoke, first of all, call that image, and then attend to, single-pointedly, to the Buddha, to Guru Rinpoche, to your own Guru, to Tara, and then die holding that image. What a nice last thought. That's kind of like guarantee. You're going someplace good, you know. Because that's going to crowd out. That's just going to leave no place for any unwholesome thoughts, craving, fear, anxiety, anger, all the kind of crap, mental afflictions that can arise, be churned up as we're dying. We're seeing we're about to lose everything. So that'd be a big advantage of that, right? What is true is that when you achieve access to the first jhana, your mind is free of all the five obscurations. And it's the same degree of freedom as if you had achieved the first jhana. That's from some really knowledgeable Theravada commentators, not me. So that's big. So you are really, the mind, your substrate consciousness is unveiled. You are now temporarily, of course it's not permanent, free of those obscurations, of those five hindrances. Right? Well, that's true no matter how you got there. Mindfulness of breathing, focusing Buddha image, settling the mind is all there. But now to answer your question, because we do have a lot of other questions here. If you got there by watching step by step, like watching the whole movie of starting the first day of settling the mind in its natural state with all the stuff that's coming up, And then watching that whole process for 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 hours, watching the whole process, eyes in a way wide open. And then watching finally the last vestiges of your coarse mind melt and dissolve, and disappear into substrate consciousness. Boy, that is just pregnant with insight. Once you arrive there, you'll have so much more insight than if you simply focus on a Buddha image or focus on an acquired sign. Right? So that's what you'd have. You'll have, those are the perks. Those are the perks. Now, it's not, if any one of these practices were simply better than all the others, then all the great teachers would only teach that one, right? That's not the case. And I'm just mentioning this very briefly, if as you're practicing shamatha, you're already thinking, I want to achieve shamatha, achieve vipassana, achieve bodhicitta, and then I want to totally devote myself to, let's say, kala chakra, stage of generation, stage of completion. I really want to go that route. Visualization would be a really good way to go to shamatha. You really develop your visualizing abilities, which then you can apply to generating the whole mandala of kala chakra. Very, very good. Very good. Now, having said that, you might first achieve shamatha by way of settling the mind into natural state, and then say, now I still want to go to kala chakra, and then achieve it all over again by focusing on a Buddha image. Yeah? You can do it quite easily. You won't have it automatically. You don't get all forms of shamatha, the fruits of all forms of shamatha by achieving one. But by achieving one, then if you turn to others, and then you say, okay, I just settled this, my mind in the substrate, now I'd like to achieve shamatha by way of a Buddha image. Good. That should be done very quickly. Okay? So it does take place, whether you're focusing on a Buddha image, a mindfulness of breathing, or visualizing, and so forth, it does take place. And that's because whether you're looking at it or not, if you are wisely and effectively practicing shamatha, just really knowing how to do the practice, the three qualities and all of that, the role of mindfulness, introspection, all of that, if you're doing that, whether or not you're watching the mind heal, it is. It is. It just happens. If you're settling the mind in its natural state, that's actually what you're watching happen, the mind healing. But if you're practicing awareness of awareness, you're not watching the mind heal. There's nothing to heal. Not in the sheer luminosity and cognizance of awareness, there's nothing to heal. Right? But if you're focusing on that, the mind does heal. So, it either takes place while you're watching or while you're not watching, but it does take place. Okay? Olas. Oh, this one from Diego. How lasting or fleeting are the changes in the subtle and coarse bodies as a result of altering the flow of prana through, altering the flow of shamatha through shamatha practice? Ah, interesting question, yeah. Well, the clearest explanation or account of this that I've seen anywhere, of the shifts of prana, how that fits in. Because most presentations of shamatha that I've encountered are really talking about what you do with the mind. Developing your stability, your vividness, and, you know, some very elaborate presentations. Tsongkhapa, more than anyone else I've seen, and drawing on these classic sources, these really stupendous sources from India and sometimes great adepts from Tibet, he also speaks about the subtle shifts of these called lelung, the karmic energies, the dynamic energies in the body, and how they are incrementally shifting. They're shifting, shifting. And a lot of you have had some experience of that already. Whether it's a bit of bliss arising or physical pain arising, so then yam. But there's a lot of movement of the furniture. As the prana is, you know, shifting, house cleaning, the prana is starting to move where they weren't moving before. Overall, especially mindfulness of breathing, tends to be really, really healing. And if you're right there in the body, that's somewhat analogous in terms of watching the subtle body heal, watching the subtle body balance itself out, the prana starting to flow properly, stiffness opening up into flexibility, and so forth. When you're practicing mindfulness of breathing, that tends to be more of a ringside seat, to be really attentive and aware of the shifts taking place in the body, right? Until you go to the acquired sign, and you're off into the mental again. So to answer your question, Tsongkhapa describes how along the nine stages leading to the achievement of shamatha, there are many incremental shifts. Many incremental shifts. Some of them can be painful, but overall it's all going in a good direction. It's really like getting a total tune-up. Like an automobile engine, getting really tuned up. And then finally when you achieve shamatha, And he really emphasizes this. It's so easy to think you've achieved shamatha before you have, especially if the account you've been given of what it is to achieve shamatha is, oh, now you can really focus clearly wherever you wish. I mean, I've seen some accounts that are that short. Now, when you can focus your attention where you will with stability and continuity, and clarity, then you've achieved shamatha. Well, yeah. But that can also occur at stage three. So what's absolutely distinctive and unprecedented about achieving shamatha? Tsongkhapa unpacks that as far as I can tell. In some ways, especially with respect to the pranas, I have not seen any parallel. Dujum Lingpa, magnificently with respect to the substrate consciousness and the substrate. So Tsongkhapa, he said when you actually achieve shamatha, then you feel these radical shifts, this kind of this free flow, the rush, the pliancy, the bliss arising in body, the mind, the whole interface between the two, almost like an echo chamber, starting with the pliancy of the mind, and that almost like echoing down to the pliancy, the flow of energies, the free flow, the total rush of energies throughout the whole body of these pranas, and that giving rise to bliss, saturating ecstasy, immobilized, you can't do much, you're just blissed out, physically blissed out. And that then surging up to the mind, and the mind saturated by bliss, right? And then everything simmering down, like the end of a fireworks display, and then everything is simmering down, or like a pot that's boiled over, and then you turn down the heat, and then it goes, and then the bliss is quite manageable. I mean, you can actually do something besides going, you know. So once that kind of shift, once that shift has taken place, because there are many shifts along the nine stages, and they're all reversible. You get them, you lose them. By the time you make that kind of energetic breakthrough, because it's a real discontinuity. Something really abrupt, some radical shift when you actually achieve shamatha. When you achieve that, it's bottom up. I mean, it's the energy shifted. The very physiological basis for your mind has now shifted. And therefore the mind is shifted. And the two, of course, in profound sync, in sync. That can be very robust. So unless you have some major accident, you know, that really massively deforms the body, or brain damage, or take some drugs, you know, some bad LSD. I mean, please don't take any drugs at all. But you imagine you got some really bad LSD. That can screw things up. And how do you know it's all illegal? So barring something like that, you should be able to keep it. Be able to keep it for life. And you take care of it. I mean, it's just common sense. If you worked hard enough, whether it took weeks, months, or years, to bring that type of radical transformation into your body and mind, you'll know how valuable it is. Nobody needs to tell you. You know how radically unlike this is compared to not having shamatha. Nobody needs to tell you. And then you'll just simply sense, well, boy, I'm keeping this one. Whatever I need to do, I'm keeping this one. No matter what, I'm not losing this. Now, if you're silly, then you'll just rest in it, you know, in the jacuzzi of the mind. But if you're intelligent, and I think everybody here is, and you have a commitment to the path, you say, I'm keeping it, and I'm using it. Then you use it the rest of your life. And my sense is, if you achieve shamatha, you apply that to cultivating bodhicitta until it arise effortlessly. Uncontrived bodhicitta. And apply that benevolent mind, magnificently, that jewel of the mind, as they say, to realization of emptiness and gain some insight, some real taste, not full Arya bodhisattva realization, but something genuine. With those three, genuine shamatha, genuine bodhicitta, you're actually a bodhisattva, some genuine insight into emptiness, then you can start talking about enlightenment in one lifetime. And it's not communist propaganda. So quite robust, that's the answer. That's from His Holiness. Oh, I'm experiencing headaches. Usually start around noon. I have tried practicing mindfulness breathing, infirmary, sending the energy to the lower part of the body, also mindful walking, but still, I notice it gets worse in the supine position. Any suggestions? Yeah, don't do that. There are some practices that work for a lot of people. There are very few practices that work for everyone. What it said? You can please some of the people some of the time? All the people all the time? Nope, not that one. So, for that, there are many strategies. Number one, when unless it's a medical condition, then go to a doctor. Now, maybe there's some medical reason you're getting headaches. Probably not, but it could be. We can all get medical conditions while in retreat. Why not? But assuming that it's not a medical condition needing medical intervention, then overall, while one is meditating rather intensively, when headaches arise, it's just because one is trying too hard and the energy is getting jailed up in the head, the locus of prana during the waking state, and then you get headaches. And so overall, bring the awareness down, 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 out of the head, below, even below the chest, down to the belly, the hips, down to the feet. Bring it down, down to the earth element. So for many people, the infirmary works. For many people, just bringing the awareness down to the hips and below works. For many people, but obviously not all. So it's not working within the container, so to speak. Now you're still getting the pressure, the prana building up in the head. If it's not dissipating, assimilating, while informal meditation, in the supine position or sitting and just releasing, releasing, if that isn't working, if you can't assimilate the energies, get them to calm down, settle down within the container, then release them out of the container. And what I mean by that is, then it's time for some exercise. And it could be fairly vigorous. And of course it could be, you know, formal exercise like yoga, tai chi, qigong. Then you go to a teacher of that. But apart from those, going out for a vigorous walk, good walk, not this one that's really closely contained, slow walking, really intensely focused here, but rather going out and letting your awareness come out. Out into the visual field, out to distant clouds, out to the sky. Your awareness come out to the auditory field, down to the ground, feet on the ground, contact in the ground, into the earth. And so let that energy get diffused out. What won't help is if you're just caught up in rumination. Because that's going to bring the energy right back into the head again. So as much as you can, this breathing out, this releasing, let the awareness expand out into space. And even if it needs to be a good walk, you know, a long walk, or exercise, cardiovascular exercise, exercise on the whole is very good. Swimming can be very good. So try that. Try that. This should not become a habit. Really do your best not to let headaches in meditation become a habit. Change something. Keep on changing it until they go away. Because that's a habit you really don't want. Yes, ma'am. That's a question. So there is a suggestion. You do the Vass breathing. That certainly tends to be a real, real effective technique for getting the attention, the awareness, and the prana out of the head. So try that. Sure. Oh, it can cause the headache. Yeah. So I think that was, yeah. Anything done too intensively. Anything done too. Overall, that would be which is fine. No name on that one. But overall, the headaches are coming because one's striving too hard. You know, that's just the general theme. Trying too hard, loosen up, chill, relax, get grounded, relax, relax. Oh, Lasso, you mentioned that the presence of Rigpa is necessary to explain extrasensory perceptions such as remote viewing and precognition since it is beyond space and time. Whether that's necessary within the Buddhist framework, who knows, maybe there are extraterrestrials that are connecting our brain to other, there's all kinds of possible explanations. I don't think very feasible. But within the Buddhist framework, barring some deva zapping to you, I actually knew somebody. I knew an Indian fellow. Did you know that Sikh, the mute Sikh back in 1971, 72? He was an interesting guy. Sounds like a joke, the mute Sikh met the Tibetan Lama. No, it's not a joke. Can you handle a story? It's kind of an interesting story. You got to hear about the mute Sikh, right? He was a very, very nice man, and I got to know him because I was living in Dr. Dundan's house, Dalai Lama's physician's house. They two were friends. He would stop by. And he was mute. He couldn't talk. But he could write. But no articulate sounds would come from him. But he can communicate by sign language, expression, and then writing. And he kind of befriended me a little, And one day he said, I got some questions for you. If you want to play, you want to do something fun? I got some questions for you. I said, okay, sure, why? I'm 21 years old. You want to play? So he asked me things like, what's your favorite color? What's your favorite number? Really like, okay, whatever. This. And then these random questions. And then he proceeded to tell me about my family and how many siblings I had, and one point after another. And everything he said was true. And he had no way of knowing it. Any of the stuff he talked about, no way, even if he were the Indian police and did a background check on me, they would know how old my sister is? I don't think so. It is not one of the things that comes up in ordinary conversation. He told me point after, and every single thing he said about me and my situation was all true. That was a jaw dropper. Like, how on earth might tell me that my color is that and this, and how do you get that? And he said, I learned the background of it, he had some clairvoyance. Some clairvoyance, not omniscient and not infallible. But he blew my mind on that one, because he came up with so many points that, statistically speaking, there's no way. Just kind of maybe this, maybe that, got them all right. So it turned out that he told me, I can't remember even how he told me, but he told me that earlier in this life, he'd known someone, another Indian fellow, or person, man, and he had this just a premonition that this fellow should not fly. He just said, just premonition, intuition, don't fly, it'd be dangerous for you. And lo and behold, the guy went off and joined the Air Force. And he died. He died in some aircraft accident. After this fellow, the Sikh, had really gone, please don't fly, he fled. And he died. Premonition should not be true. What he told me was this fellow was then born as a deva, that naturally have extrasensory perception, and the deva then befriended him for trying to have given him the good warning, which he had ignored, and so the deva would slip him information. And that's how he got the information about me. So can I say that it's only pristine awareness? Well, gosh, I don't know. But then we can say, how did the deva know? Where did the deva live? In California? Was it a California deva? You know? They all live in Malibu. I doubt it. I tend to ramble. You know that by now. You know me well. Ramble on. Within the Buddhist framework of coarse mind, it doesn't make any sense. In terms of clairvoyance, remote viewing, or seeing things in the future, precognition or remote viewing. Coarse mind, forget about it. I mean, it rises independent upon the brain. The brain is located inside a skull. It's got no communication outside. And there's no way in terms of modern physics to understand that. It just doesn't make any sense. Not in quantum cosmology or Newtonian physics. So coarse mind, if that's all there is, this shouldn't be possible. Substrate consciousness has never been over yonder now, and it's never been to the future, so it doesn't have, it's not in the database. Past life, yeah. Future or someplace distant right now, no way. It has no access to it. And so, when you go to pristine awareness, which is beyond space and time, insofar as like tendrils of knowledge, bubbles of knowledge float up from that, they may illuminate things in distant space or in the future. So that's one way of understanding it within that threefold kind of framework of cognition. However, you can develop such extrasensory perception on the basis of shamatha without realizing rikpa, correct? That is true. That is true. And it is certainly true according to all schools of Buddhism. But going back to Buddha Gosa, Visuddhimagga, and so forth, he'll tell you exactly on the basis of having achieved jhana, shamatha or jhana, 1, 2, 3, 4 jhanas and so forth, he gives you exact exercises, methods for developing different types of extrasensory perception. Right? Tells you exactly how to do it. There's no reference to rikpa. No reference to preceding content, omniscient, all of that. And so he's not going to understand that in terms of pristine awareness. He will be understanding that in terms of form realm and formless realm. Okay? Now, the fact that they don't refer to it doesn't mean it doesn't exist and doesn't mean you're not tapping into it. So here's the point. You may be tapping into or gaining glimmerings from shafts of light of recognition, of clarity, of intuition, of knowledge from pristine awareness without fully realizing pristine awareness. Right? That certainly happens. Yes, Andre. Maybe we'd have the microphone. But again, before we get the microphone there, you can get the benefit of Rigpa without having to realize it. Some of the benefits, some of the glimmerings, without having realization of it. Go ahead.
No, it was just a point regarding the six clairvoyance and the five eyes.
Exactly.
The Montaguen, the Abhismaya Lankara says that there are actually three causes for it. One is the accomplishment of dhyana.
Yes.
The other is the ripening of a karma.
Karma can happen, yeah.
So you can actually in this life have ripening karma, which makes you to have five clairvoyance. Not all of them, obviously,
yeah,
because some are super, well, transcendent.
Right.
And then the third one is mantras.
Mantra, yeah.
Mantra, you know.
Yeah. Mantra is a mantra, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's mysterious. I mean, simply to say ripening of karma, well, that means you must have some pretty good karma back then, because if you just ripen some rotten karma, then that's not going to be so good. And so if it's ripening of karma, then how do you get it in the first place? I mean, what was that karma that accumulated, and how do you get it? So it is mysterious, but I think in terms of just under a framework of understanding consciousness altogether, right, this one strikes me as being the most obvious, and that is if there's a dimension of consciousness, which, bear in mind, it's not like it's hidden someplace. Pristine awareness is present right now. It saturates every single moment. It saturates your mind when you're angry, when you're happy, when you're sad, when you're asleep. Pristine awareness is saturating every moment of experience 24 hours a day at all times. So it's always present. It's always present. And it's only a matter of the degree to which we recognize it. But it's not someplace else. It's not dormant. It's not a potential. Not in Dzogchen view. So this means, in principle, the knowledge that is implicit in Rigpa should be available at any time. And so it may be aroused by use of mantra, aroused by use of dhyana, aroused by the ripening of earlier karma. All of those are possible. When I was translating for His Holiness in Athens in 1979, a woman came to him, said, and she was middle-aged, like 45, and she said just recently, over the last couple of years, she suddenly found that she could heal people. Just she would lay hands on them and they would heal. And she did not have that ability, and then she just found they would heal. And she asked him, what's going on? There was nothing ostentatious or look at me, I'm so special. It's like, I don't get this. How is this happening? And His Holiness responded, oh yeah, that happens. Ripening of karma. Ripening of karma. And he said, don't be surprised if you lose it. You know, it came out of the blue. It may disappear back into the blue. The fact that it manifests when you're 45 doesn't mean you'll have it when you're 65. It's a ripening of karma, then sometimes the karma just gets exhausted and you'll lose it. Or you may sustain it. So there it is. It's mysterious. Nothing more in the phenomenal world is mysterious than, more mysterious than karma. Yes, and that's exactly right. This implies that there is access to it without its realization. That's true. It has access to us. And as an example of this, no, not an example, an analogy. And that is, a number of you have experienced, on one session or another, when you're in relative beginners in shamatha, on occasion you've had those really good days you love to report on, where the mind just becomes really still, just effortlessly, just pin drop silent. Some of you express, on occasion, the mind becomes so clear, so radiant, so bright. And some of you said on occasion, either in the body or the mind, just bliss just suddenly arises. Okay? That's without having achieved shamatha, I'm presuming, unless you're really trying to fool me, you know. Without having achieved shamatha, without having realized substrate consciousness, so you just know it like the palm of your hand, nevertheless, these so-called like shafts of light, sometimes bliss, sometimes luminosity, sometimes non-conceptuality, they got to be coming from somewhere. They're not coming from your coarse mind. That doesn't make any sense. Coarse mind is all stimulus-driven, right? So you're getting the glimmerings, you're getting benefits, you're getting shafts of light from the substrate consciousness manifesting in that way. It can happen also. It can happen even before you've achieved shamatha, that if your dreams become clear, 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 very, very clear, then during those last 2 hours of your sleep, if you're getting a full night's sleep, it can happen that you may have events arising in the dream for which the karmic seeds, that is the bubbles, the potencies, the karmic seeds, actually were not stored in this lifetime. Most dreams are. You see something come up and it's reminiscent of something you've experienced in this life. But it can happen, even without being highly realized, that especially in that last phase of sleep, last couple of hours before you wake up fully rested, that the seeds that are ripening and manifesting, germinating in the dream, those seeds may be from a past life. And when you have a dream where you feel, I'm sure I've never been here before, this is totally outside my experience, and it's really, really clear, and it may be significant, then that could be something coming up from previous life. Okay? It can happen. Voilà, time's running. You spoke this morning about seeing everything as the compassionate display of Rigpa. Yeah. While I find the entire idea rather hard to grasp, I particularly don't understand why the display is compassionate. Compassionate in what sense? Yeah, this is something where this can so easily become a matter of religious dogma. And has. Or doctrine. Again, I don't want to be deprecating here, because people get benefit from all kinds of beliefs. So there's a Christian belief that no matter what happens, a natural catastrophe, a tsunami that kills 250,000 people, earthquake, floods, droughts, famines, pestilence, bubonic plague. And there are people who believe that this is all the will of God. And no matter what it is, God has a plan. Mysterious are the ways of the Lord. Accept it, because there's some greater good here. And you'll find out about it when you're in heaven. Until then, just have faith. And that includes the death of a child, and so forth and so on. I was never able to believe that, but many people do, and I think they find some solace in that belief. That's not the Buddhist belief. That is absolutely not the Buddhist belief. From the coarse mind, things are just happening, and ask the scientists why they happened. Why was it the tsunami? They'll tell you there was an earthquake here, there was a seismic wave, and the wave traveled 450 miles an hour across the ocean, and wham, people got killed. And that's why it happened, right? We don't need anything supernatural. And so, on the coarse level of mind, you look for the causes, and there they are. Problem solved. We don't need to invoke anything outside of that. We don't really need to invoke karma on that level. Hey, it's an earthquake. From a deeper level, from the perspective of substrate consciousness, then, yeah, but why did these people suffer and others did not? Klaus's villa is right overlooking the Andaman Sea. That's where the tsunami came. Right overlooking there. Just up north of his place is a beach. And he told me, there's nothing really personal about this, so I would never violate his privacy. But he loves to run. He's a runner. He's an athlete. And he had his route that he ran frequently. And his route went right by a beach. But on the day of the tsunami, he decided to change the route. Otherwise, we might not have any mind center, etc. So, that was his karma. From the Buddhist perspective, we say that was his karma. He didn't have the karma to die there, and other people did. There's nothing good about it. There's nothing compassionate about it. Negative seeds were sown, and there's suffering. No second negative seed was sown. It didn't hit his house. The water, the ocean right in front of his house is very deep. The tsunami wave doesn't build up. It needs a kind of a shallow platform to build up and then do the massive damage. So he didn't have the karma for anything to be harmed, not his body or his house. Good. He didn't have the karma to be harmed by the tsunami, not directly. So from that perspective, then we see it, okay, this is ripening of karma. There's nothing compassionate about it. There is a seed, there's the result. From the perspective of Rigpa, and if you don't have it, you don't have it. But from the perspective of Rigpa, for oneself in the middle of the mandala, so the wording here is really crucial, that we don't turn this into something ghastly really, really quick. Like children dying of AIDS in Africa. Oh, actually, that was something compassionate. You know, it can really get ghastly really quickly. But with oneself in the center of the mandala, of the world that is arising in relationship to you, since there is, in Dzogchen view, there is no world already out there, a predetermined, already self-existent. The world is arising. Every sentient being is in the center of that sentient being's mandala of the universe. From the perspective of Rigpa, as a person along the path, but viewing reality from the perspective of Rigpa, all appearances arising to you, to your awareness, They're all displays. They're rang nam. They're your own appearances of Rigpa. And they are arising as expressions of compassion for you. Every moment is an aid to your practice. And some will call it adversity and some will call it felicity. But you'll see everything is just an ongoing wave. It's a 360 degree wave, a tsunami of blessing. That everything is arising as an aid in your practice. And that includes your own mental afflictions. Even the mental afflictions arise as aids on your path. From your perspective. For you, from that perspective. It's very up close, intimate, and personal. You never then turn to another person who's just gotten ill, or is getting really angry, or has just been hit by a car, and say, oh, but that was compassion. You never do that. It's from your perspective. Anything to add or subtract? It's very subtle. And one doesn't need to believe it. There's no creed here. Oh, if you don't believe that, you can't practice Dzogchen. No, this is one of those things you can discover. But you see the drum roll. You know, boom. The drum roll starts with, well, make lemonade out of lemons. The drum roll is, if you can do something about it, why be unhappy? If you can't do something, why be unhappy? The drum roll is lojong. Deliberately interacting, engaging with, shifting attitude, bringing understanding of emptiness, bringing bodhicitta, cultivating renunciation, bringing it all to bear, and getting in there and wrestling with reality. Wrestle, you don't punch, right? It's not boxing, it's not slugging. It's getting in there and wrestling with reality and shaping it and saying, this is reality is presenting me with something that many people would call adversity, and I'm now going to get wrestled with it. And I'm going to shape it around until now for me it's no longer adversity. Now for me this was a great boon. It helped me develop much deeper renunciation. That much deeper, greatly deeper my compassion. This really aroused my passion for enlightenment. This brought greater loving kindness. This was a wonderful purification of karma. I needed that. One way or another, actively engaging, you see all appearances because you've really embraced your role as the observer participant. We don't have to ignore quantum cosmology here. You've embraced your role as an observer participant. That's exactly what you are. You are an observer, but you're also a participant. And you're shaping reality by shifting your attitude. It's called lojong, transformation of your attitude, your perspective. And that way you're preparing. Then we go into stage of generation, which has as a prerequisite seeing the emptiness of all phenomena, including the emptiness of adversity. Nothing is inherently adverse. Nothing is inherently felicitous. And actually seeing that, not just believing it, but seeing there's nothing coming that is inherently good or bad, pleasant or unpleasant. Knowing that, then on that basis, and with all the much richer context of sage regeneration, then by the power of imagination, rooted in wisdom, then one sees all phenomena. One views all phenomena, deliberately getting in there and imagining all phenomena arising in that fashion. But it's a play of imagination, you know it, but it's rooted in wisdom. It's not just looking through reality through rose-tinted glasses. It's much, much, infinitely deeper than that. But when you go to Dzogchen, there's no imagining. There's no pretending. There's no as if. It's just the way things appear. So it can be as straight. It can be as slender, as sleek a path. Shamatha, Vipassana, straight to Dzogchen. Realize Rigpa. And that's just how things appear. For you, everything is a display of compassion. But not somebody else's. Somebody rewarding you for, oh, good for you. You realize Rigpa. Now I'll throw a bunch of good stuff at you. So rangnam, your own appearances. Okay. Oh, yeah. Maybe this time for one more quick. Oh, yeah. Yep. Is there a quick one? Got through most of them here. Here's a fairly quick one, and this one comes tomorrow. And I won't bring this tomorrow. Oh, I don't like myself. I don't either. So I love done wrong things in the past. I have done wrong things in the past. Shame on you. Since I've encountered the Dharma, I've tried to change. That's good. That's what Dharma's for. Still, there is a sense of being too hard on myself that I just can't get rid of. and it is an obstacle in my life and in my practice. I completely sympathize with you. Completely sympathize. From my heart. Yeah. We've done wrong things in the past, and the one really good thing about the past is that it's past. It is no more. It is no more. And whatever lingering effects there are from the past can be changed in the present. The past can't be, of course. It's water under the bridge. Our perspective on it can, as we go back to quantum cosmology, how the past arises to us, is relevant to how we attend to it, the kind of questions we pose to the past. Right? But try to change, yeah. I'll maybe just close with a brief comment by Shantideva. Not many people know it, I don't think, because it's not in his well-known classic, A Guide to the Bodhisattva Way of Life. It's in another one that is much less, much frequently read. It's called Shiksha Samujaya, or the Companion of Practice. It's much larger, many, many citations from the sutras. Right towards the beginning of the text, he's talking about remorse, about, you know, having a voluntary awareness, knowledge, recollection of the bad things we've done in the past. And the power of the remedial powers, the efficacy of the four remedial powers to look back upon them with a lot of intelligence and simply recognizing there's a reason that was, that's unwholesome behavior. Whether it was kind of trivial, but it was still negative, stealing Brill Cream boxes. They probably, you know, when I think about that, I mean, it's not heinous, but nevertheless, is that wholesome or unwholesome? It's unwholesome. And probably, the storekeeper who's just trying to make a decent living, he probably couldn't sell the tubes with no box, because people think maybe you screwed with it. So, I might as well just have stole the cream itself. But I just wanted to go bowling, you know? So something like that, I mentioned it, it's fairly trivial, but nevertheless it's unwholesome. That wasn't a nice thing to do. It was totally self-centered. And of course I felt very clever, just like Madoff. Must have felt incredibly clever when he stole how many billions of dollars. How smart am I? And so did I think the same thing. I am so clever, I'm just stealing the boxes and I'm getting away with it. Boy, was a fun bowling. You know? So we see something. Clearly I've done worse things than steal Brill Cream boxes in my life. So, but there's a trivial one, since I wanted to just bring out something not too heavy duty. You know, but we look back on other things that we've done more injuriously. And then why do we call them unwholesome? Well, that's kind of clear. It's not mysterious, and not just because Buddha said so. It's because they harm. They bring harm to ourselves and others. That's why they're unwholesome. Right? And so looking back with remorse, legitimate remorse, and then having the resolve to avoid in the future, taking whatever means necessary to purify the act, the power of resolve, cultivating compassion, cultivating refuge. So I won't give a whole talk on those four. But there's ways of simply whatever the past is, and in the Buddhist worldview overall, it doesn't matter what you've done, it can be one of the worst acts possible of a human being, and it can still be purified. There's nothing so evil that we can do that it can't be purified. But the point from Shantideva, all of this is well known to all knowledgeable Buddhists, but the point from Shantideva, not so commonly cited, is while acknowledging the value of feeling remorse, developing strong resolve not to repeat, to purify, do whatever we can to purify, he says, don't overdo it. And that is, don't keep on going back to the same, and always mea culpa. Mea culpa. How bad am I? And just keep beating yourself up over it. How could I have done that? I'm so bad. All that is just more cognitive fusion of I am bad because I did that in the past, whereas, you know, it's all in a state of flux. You're just reinforcing delusion. To keep on going back, I am bad. How is this going to be leading you towards enlightenment when you're just reifying yourself, fusing yourself with your own bad actions? So he said there's a role for this, applying the remorse, the resolve, and so forth. And then he said, then leave it, move on, because if you keep on beating yourself up, it'll take all the joy out of the practice, and you won't proceed on the path. If the enthusiasm is gone, and you're always binding or shackling yourself to the errors of your past, How will you ever take delight in the present and the possibility of freedom? So it's striking that balance. And as a psychological truth and as a Buddhist truth, it is never helpful to fuse your identity with either your mental afflictions or the negative acts that come out of them. It's never helpful. Number one, it's not true. No person is a mental affliction and no person is an action, whether it's a good action or a bad action. It's just not true. People are not actions. People are not mental afflictions. So don't fuse your identity with it. It's a real bad partner. It's a real bad mate to fuse yourself with that. Recognize they come, they go. I'm going to end with one really good story. I didn't make up it. It's a great analogy. I think it gives the right ambience. And I'll leave it, and then we'll have dinner. It's the story of the bad chili. It could be any kind of meal. It could be tsampa. I can't remember how it was told to me. But so imagine three people come into a diner, and they all order the same food. It could be eggs. Doesn't matter. I'm going to say it's chili. Chili con carne. Okay? And they all sit down. It's served at the same time. And one guy's really hungry. The three guys, you know, come to socialize, chat and so forth, and have some chili con carne while they're doing it. But one guy's really hungry, and he while the other two guys are talking, he's chowing down, you know. And he's eaten almost the whole bowl before the other two guys started. But the second guy starts, after a while, the second guy, he starts really chowing down, while the third guy is still talking. So the second guy, he really starts, and he's into it. And then the third guy, he's just barely begun his meal. Okay, so real sequence. The first guy that really chowed down, swallowed the whole bowl, after a little while, he suddenly lurches and said, "Ah!" Oh. He's in agony. He just feels like his insides are being ripped apart. There's something really bad, whether it was ground glass, whether it was rotten meat, whatever it was, it's hitting him hard. And he falls over on the ground and he says, "Oh, this is killing me. I think I'm going to die." And his two companions, knowing they all ate the same food out of the same pot, they'll be experiencing something now. It's called remorse. It's not called guilt. It's not called guilt. It's not like, "I'm such a terrible person. Buddha, forgive me." It's like, "Oh, no. I'm going to be like that in, let's see, about 5 minutes." And before it hits me, 911, pump the stomach, give me a raw egg, give me anything. I want to get that stuff out of my system, and I'm never eating here again. Right? So you feel intense remorse, because you see, that's what's going to happen. If you just sit on this, that's you, right there. You'll be three really sad people on the ground, you know. Intense remorse, not because you're a bad person, but because you ate bad food. Intense remorse, but then wanting to get it out of your system as quickly as possible, and then having a strong resolve, "I'm never eating in this restaurant again." Okay? So, I'm a bad person, I'm a good person, I'm a guilty person, I like myself. Those questions don't even come up. The issues don't come up. It's just, that was bad food. Get it out of your system, and then you'll be healthy. So if we consider mental afflictions and the actions that come out of them as like bad chili, that's probably more realistic. Okay? Oh, having said that, if there's any chili in there, you might want to be careful. Enjoy your meal. See you a little bit later.